And I believe relationship is everything. And, you know, being the type of leader that people can trust.
Yeah.
You know, do people believe what you say? Mm-hmm. Can you follow through with the things that you say? Mm-hmm. And are you sincere? And really continually to build that trust. Mm-hmm. And I find that in all facets, you know, is really the critical piece.
Hello, and thanks for listening to I Love Cincinnati, a podcast that showcases the people who are building and affecting change in the city. I'm your host, Chuck Mingo, and today I'm interviewing Chief Elliot Isaac of the Cincinnati Police. In any sizable city in America, one of the chief influencers of the culture and climate of the city is the police chief. It's a demanding job and one that requires a special mix of strong leadership and a strong desire to serve every citizen in the community. As you listen to my conversation with Chief Isaac, I hope that you'll realize, like I did, just how fortunate we are to have his leadership in our city. Chief Isaac moved here when he was 12 years old from Gary, Indiana, and has always had an interest in being a police officer. He spent some time in the National Guard and joined the Cincinnati Police in 1988. He's celebrating his 31st year in law enforcement this year, and as you'll hear today, he's had quite a journey.
So you came to Cincinnati at 12, so middle school.
Right.
So talk about that. What was it like? What were your first experiences in the city that you can recall?
You know, it was a new, I grew up in, actually out in the suburbs of okay. Cincinnati in Forest Park. Moved there. At the time, it was a very mixed, diverse neighborhood. It was a myriad of experiences. That was a time in the late 70s where our country was still undergoing a lot of transitions. I remember we moved here in 1978.
Okay.
And that was the same time that the miniseries Roots came out.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So that was some of my early exposure to some racism and really experiencing that firsthand.
Yeah.
So it was a myriad of experiences.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So dad's job brings you here.
Yes.
So tell me about your families.
I am one of four boys.
Wow. Okay.
Mom and dad. Yes. So I am the middle child. I'm the third of four.
Okay.
My younger brother is also a police officer. He's a lieutenant with our department, in charge of our vice and narcotics section.
Mm-hmm. Is he a good employee? Does he follow directions really well?
He is at least on duty.
All right. What he says to you off duty is a separate
whole
thing.
Whole different matter, right.
That's great. That's great. So, you know, I mean, obviously choosing to be a police officer, there's a bunch of different paths that people take to their career. What was it for you? When did you know that this is what you wanted to do with your life?
You know, it was something that very early on, it kind of struck me that I always had an interest for this. I was that kid that played cops and robbers, and I knew that I would either go into the military or become a police officer. Actually did a combination of both. Did some time in the National Guard, and I'm in my 31st year with the department. So something that I kind of always wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. Were you always with Cincinnati Police Department?
I have been, I joined this department in 1988.
Wow.
And been here and came up through the ranks.
Yeah.
So.
Gosh, so many questions come to mind for me. One is, you know, you've seen so much change in culture and obviously in policing. So, what kind of mindset do you think it takes to navigate all the changes that you've had to navigate in your career? I mean, it's just an interesting leadership study.
You know, I think it is being a part of the profession evolving. And that's one of the things that I've been able to see in the past three decades is the evolution of law enforcement. Just speaking here locally, looking at the fashion in which we policed the neighborhoods, you know, when I started in the late 80s and early 90s versus how we approach it now is like night and day.
Yeah.
You know, beginning my career, you know, the mindset was that we as law enforcement, we knew best. We were the professionals. We knew what to do. Everybody pay attention to what we say. It doesn't matter what you think or what you want. We know how the streets are supposed to be policed. And we did a lot of things. We did and I have to say, people with good hearts thinking they were doing the right thing, we did a lot of harm. You know, we caused a lot of impact in neighborhoods that weren't necessary. That was also the time of the crack cocaine boom.
Yeah.
And, you know, the quote unquote war on drugs. And the mindset was, you know, we need to eradicate our neighborhoods of this drug. So that meant anybody that touched it, whether you were a seller, a user, or you allowed it to take place in your residence and some of the low-income housing, everybody went to jail.
Wow.
And there you had the age of mass incarceration.
Yeah.
And it disproportionately affected, you know, minority communities. And a lot of harm was done. And I think, you know, communities are still suffering from that. Obviously, now the approach is much different.
Yeah.
Now we see another epidemic, and now, you know, the emphasis is more on, hey, this is a disease. People need to be treated. We need to do things to help.
Yeah.
And make sure that we're not causing harm. Mm-hmm. So very, a very vastly different approach to the same problem.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right, though. There's the shift in thinking and the mindset. Mm-hmm. And I just appreciate even your honesty and being able to reflect on the past and say there was some harm done in the name of trying to eradicate what was an incredibly harmful thing.
Absolutely.
The drug epidemic. And in that way, as you think about that change, I know that Cincinnati is unique in this way. So, you know, I told you this a little bit off camera. I'll say it here. You know, born and raised in Philadelphia. So my view of policing came out of a big city like Philadelphia. And in coming to Cincinnati, it was really, I came at the end of 2000 into 2001, which, as we know, was a very, you know, there was a lot going on.
Absolutely.
Particularly with the Cincinnati police and that. And out of that came things like the collaborative agreement. And even out of this context, this idea of community-oriented policing that I think really makes our city different. So just talk about that from your perspective, because obviously you would have been here during that transition.
Well, you know, and there's been an evolution of that. You know, the first stab at community policing was really just get to know your neighbors, get to know people and be known. And that was something that even before it had a moniker that many of us did, that we knew the value of being out walking in the neighborhoods and having people know you. People are more willing to share information with you. They're more willing to assist and work on any problems in the neighborhood if there's a relationship. Relationship is the key. Well, then, you know, you went into a little bit further and some of the other things that developed out of community policing, some of the broken windows theories were, you know, addressing the, you know, the low level problems which led to the big problems and some of those things. To where we evolve now and coming out of the collaborative agreement that we more focus on community problem-oriented policing, where the community and the police department work together to solve problems in the community, utilizing a model, the SARA model, where we have a strategy and how we look at problems, how we approach it, and if at first you don't succeed, you try again. And something we still thrive to work at.
What I love about that is what you said about relationship. I think that the police, you know, police-citizen relationship can easily be seen as an us versus them on either side.
Correct.
And what I hear you saying is, what does it look like to sit on the same, like what we're doing right now, sitting on the same side of the table and looking at the problem and saying, how can we together in community and relationship solve it?
Absolutely, absolutely. As you know, one of the things that I've seen is that we certainly can't do it alone. Anytime the police try to go at it alone, you're destined for failure. You know, and I think that everything that we do now around that, and we still have work to do, we're not perfect and we fall short at times, But the thought behind it is that we have to have that public trust. We have to have their input, their involvement. Mm-hmm. So those times when we make mistakes and something goes wrong, that it's that relationship that will carry the day.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We there's a model I learned, five capitals. You know, like there's five capitals we have, and one of them is relational capital. And I think that's what you're talking about is there, you build up relational capital because you recognize in any relationship, you're going to have to spend some of it.
Absolutely.
Right.
Got to make those deposits.
Got to make the deposits.
So when you have a withdrawal,
right?
It's the same way in your marriage relationship.
That's right.
You constantly make those deposits. Mm-hmm, so when that time is needed for a withdrawal, it's there available
to you. That's exactly
right.
You don't want insufficient funds
in
that relationship.
Because that results you in 3 days of civil unrest.
Yes. Yes, and those are things that none of us want to see.
Yeah, nobody wants to see.
So tell me this, Mike. I'm going to make a guess, and I don't know because I'm not a police officer. But my guess is that in some ways, the skills that you need to be a good lieutenant, sergeant, captain are the same that you need to be a chief. But then I'm going to guess that in some ways it's very, very different. I'm gonna make an assumption. You just left City Hall and having conversations in it. I don't know that anything in your career up to the point would have prepared you for that. Maybe I'm wrong. So just clue us in on what kind of leadership transition is it when you ultimately become the chief of police?
It is a very dramatic shift. You deal with things that you just don't have the opportunity to deal with at any other level. You know, I think that I was very well versed in what it took or how the department operated, all of the different functions that take place. I was a captain for 11 years, and I had the opportunity to work in many of the bureaus in the department and to see the functions. I felt very confident about that, but all of the pieces to the puzzle that you have that brings this thing together is very complex.
I would imagine.
You know, there's three things that chiefs talk about. That this like there's a three-legged stool that you have to sit on and balance to be a police chief. You got the community, you got City Hall, the politicians, and you got to balance the rank and file, what takes place in your department. And at any time you don't have your arms around two or three of those, you've got problems.
Okay.
You've got major problems. That if you're at least not, you know, sitting well with two of the three of those at any given time, you're in some serious danger.
I would imagine. So it's interesting. So what would you say, what are you learning right now in your role? I mean, you've been in your role for a while, but what are the things that you're learning or what are the things that right now you're growing in your own leadership?
Well, it's the same thing that we just talked about is that relationship piece. And I believe relationship is everything. And, you know, being the type of leader that people can trust, you know, do people believe what you say? Can you follow through with the things that you say? And are you sincere? And really continually to build that trust. And I find that in all facets, you know, is really the critical piece.
Yeah. What keeps you up at night these days?
You know, I tell you, the violent crime, the what I see happening with our young people, that young people are being hurt by violent crime. And I'm really happy that we've made some progress there, but it's still a very difficult challenge in our country. We, you know, in the 3.5 years that I've been chief, every year we've had reductions in violent crime. Last year, we actually had a record reduction. And so far through the first half of the year, we're even shooting less than that. But we had a very ugly weekend this past weekend that really concerns me. You know, this is the time of the year where violence is most high. And that concerns me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know that these are accurate statistics. I'm sure you would know the accurate statistics, mm-hmm. but one of the things that breaks my heart around that violent mm-hmm. crime is that, you know, I think we might get a picture in mind of the person mm-hmm. who's behind that trigger. Mm-hmm. And again, I asked for you to clarify this, but that number is getting younger and younger is what I understand.
You know, largely it is. And there's so many social factors behind that. And the more and more that we delve into this and we peel back that onion, mm-hmm. I know and I believe we've got solid strategies in place where we've got great partnerships. We're leveraging a lot of technology that is giving us some success. Mm-hmm. But until some of those social conditions are really changed, we're only gonna go so far. Mm-hmm. And that means dealing with the issues that are really plaguing our communities. Yeah. Education mm-hmm. is the biggest key. Mm-hmm. You know, housing, mm-hmm. you know, living wage paying jobs, you know, all of these things play together that really create crime conditions in a neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And until those things are really impacted, we're going to continue to fight this challenge.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you and I would share a vision of our city that there's opportunity for everybody in our city.
There's tremendous opportunity.
And for that to be true, like you said, these are the factors that come to play.
It just has to be realized for everyone.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. Man, that's a sobering reminder to all of us. And again, mm-hmm. it goes back to what you said about the community partnership. Obviously, solutions for many of those problems aren't designed to come out of the police force.
Correct.
Right.
Often, though, we are looked to.
Absolutely, right.
But mm-hmm. but I get that.
Yeah.
Because we are the 365 day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week representation of government.
Yes.
That people, we're police and fire are the only ones you can pick up the phone 24 hours a day mm-hmm. and we will come.
Yeah, you're right.
We're the only ones that will do that. And, you know, so you often find yourself mm-hmm. faced with, you know, the challenges of conditions that aren't traditionally law enforcement problems. Mm-hmm. Kids that haven't eaten, that don't have enough to eat. And how can you focus in school if you haven't eaten in a day and a half?
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, and these are the challenges that we see, you know, and you're wondering why these kids are misbehaving.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a challenge.
It is a challenge. So I came to Cincinnati at the end of 2000s. And so when 2001 happened and, you know, the Stephen Roach, Timothy Thomas, all of that and the social unrest that followed, I remember driving home. I remember being in Hyde Park and I was living in Mason and I was driving home because I had to get outside the city limits mm-hmm. before the curfew hit. And just, you know, didn't have a context for that kind of thing. Really hadn't seen that in our country, and mm-hmm. at least for me, hadn't heard about it since about the 60s. That was my perspective. You had a very different perspective because you were on the force. So can you talk about what that was like?
You know, definitely. I had a lot of different perspectives mm-hmm. Of that. First, a little history on how that came to be. You know, this was a time in our city where, and I talked about it a little bit in some of the previous questions on the way and the fashion in which we were conducting our police operations. Mm-hmm. We had experienced a number of officer-involved shootings, particularly a number of them that involved unarmed men, in which the officers were deemed justified as a result. This angered the community and created a very challenging situation. The community felt that unarmed men were being killed at the hands of police, i.e. the government, mm-hmm. and weren't able to obtain justice through the court system. One of the things that I think that really caused it to boil over was just the way in which we approached the investigations, mm-hmm. the transparency piece. People were screaming and crying out for information, for facts, what took place. And at that time, we were very guarded in the way in which we conducted those investigations. We're very different now. Mm-hmm. Now, within 24 hours of an officer-involved shooting, we'll have a press conference. Mm-hmm. We'll share all the information that we know up to that point. We'll share any body camera video, any video footage available, any weapons used or involved in it, and share that information. One of the valuable lessons is that bad news doesn't get any better by holding it.
That's true.
And mm-hmm. I think that, and when we talk about, again, talk about those relationships, you know, people can handle bad news. People can even handle that an officer made a mistake, mm-hmm. or something had gone wrong, but what they can't handle mm-hmm. is when they feel lied to or when they feel that something is being covered up. Yeah. That just makes a community enraged.
Yeah, you talked about public trust.
Public trust.
And that's a really critical thing. There's an authority that comes with being a police officer and being part of the force.
Correct.
But with that, there's a public trust that there's a transparency.
Absolutely.
And that's what you recognize.
And there's a legitimate expectation mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. that, you know, people can have and should be able to have confidence that they're going to get the truth of what occurred.
Yes.
But getting back to that time, I was a sergeant during that time. And being out and seeing the civil unrest and fall, I tell you, it's a unique thing. It's something that as a police officer, something that you only see once in a career.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's something that I've never seen before and never really seen since, where to be standing on the street and see hundreds of enraged, angry people mm-hmm. coming towards you. You know, now we're seeing a lot more protests, but we've been fortunate here in Cincinnati that they have not been violent.
Right.
But during that time, angry people, and something that you don't see very often. Mm-hmm. That was something that I knew I never wanted to see again.
Yeah.
And even now, when we have demonstrations, mm-hmm. the way we even approach that. You know, more often than not, we really try to facilitate that protest.
Right. Right.
And mm-hmm. communicate with the leaders of that protest. Hey, what do you want to say? What do you want to do?
Yep.
How can we make this safe for everyone?
Yes.
You know, so that you can exercise, you know, your First Amendment rights mm-hmm. and, you know, and this is a safe gathering for everybody.
Yeah.
You know,
so I've been a part of some of those mm-hmm. and I have seen the police do that. I've seen the police facilitate that. There's not been a hostility in the ones that I've seen. Yeah. And in fact, there has been more of a, we support that this is your right, and we're here to allow that.
And one of the last things that we want to do is draw a line in the sand.
Right.
When you draw a line in the sand, then you're asking for that confrontation.
That's right.
Now, there are a few things that we won't allow to happen.
Sure.
And again, mm-hmm. it's about people's safety.
Yeah.
But by and large, if you want to march, well, we'll allow that to happen. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I've seen that. So 2001, you know, just, you know, maybe give us a little bit more around what was questions that come to mind for me. You had to go home at the end of that.
It was.
And you had a family that you were going home to.
I did.
And I'm sure they had questions. You know, I can only imagine if my dad was in your position.
Right.
And I'm seeing this unfold, but I hadn't gotten a chance to talk to dad yet. Like,
well, but you know, mm-hmm. I think you have to, there were many of us at the time on the department mm-hmm. that saw that we were headed in this direction.
Okay.
Because of the things that had taken place in the years up to this, mm-hmm. that we were headed towards this, and you know that this was a tipping point, and it caused the department to change.
Mm-hmm.
It forced a lawsuit that followed, mm-hmm. That was settled with what we now refer to as our historic collaborative agreement.
That's right.
And out of that, we had several years of Department of Justice oversight that really oversaw a lot of the changes that took place in the department. And a lot of very good things came out of it. And even in the years since, we've still continued to try to adhere to those. And right now we're in the process of a refresh of a lot of those things, just to continue to stay in that same vein.
Yeah.
So, you know, some of the things that we think are commonplace now, what was one of the main things I recall that came out of it were the in-car cameras.
Yeah. Okay.
Prior to that, we didn't have that. So that was one of the things. And also the way in which we monitor our officers, if there are early warning signs of how officers are, or the conduct that they're engaging in, citizen complaints, the types of traffic stops and how those things are being conducted, you know, things that we monitor now that weren't taking place before.
Yeah.
And then the commitment to engage in problem solving as our principal strategy in addressing violent crime. And we've continued to build off of that in the years since.
Yeah, that's a good foundation to build off of.
Absolutely.
It really is. You know, what are some of the most memorable moments for you? Things that you'll just never forget? And obviously you can share.
Well, clearly some of the things that you never forget is seeing the loss of life of your brother officers.
Yeah.
I joined the department in 1988, and we had an officer killed in the line of duty, Cliff George, the year before. So joining in 1988, we hadn't seen an officer lost in the line of duty until 1997.
Wow.
And so we went almost a decade, and that was when Dan Pope and Ron Jeter were killed in the line of duty. And that was my first experience with that. And, you know, I wasn't there that night. I was off that night that it occurred. But getting that call at 2 a.m. as to what had happened, I was a new sergeant. And getting that call was very good friends with Ron Jeter. And hearing that is something, you know, very challenging. And then we saw the loss of Kevin Crayon, you know, a few years later. And then the loss of Sonny Kim
recently,
in 2015. So those are the things that really I think you'll never forget.
Yeah.
And then also just some of the tragic situations that you see as a result of this that kind of stick with you.
Yeah.
You know, the things that have really stuck with me is when I've seen, you know, injuries or the loss of life to children.
Yeah.
And those things have stuck with me the most.
It just, that makes me think about even the Fifth Third.
And even that, shooting, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, you know, to see the response that our officers had on that, you know, I've never been prouder, you know, of the department, and to be the leader of the organization during that time, I'm extremely proud of the work that they've done.
Yeah.
Another proud day, my daughter, when she joined the police,
I
had the opportunity to swear her in as a police officer.
Man.
So, you know, another proud day.
I bet. So there's three Isaac.
There are three Isaacs right now in the police department.
So, you know, one of the things that I love is just the opportunity to sit and connect with you, just to hear your heart and who you are behind the uniform.
Right.
And yet, you are a city leader. You are definitely one of the people who influences this city greatly. And I know that you love and care for our city. So tell me your vision for Cincinnati. What are the dreams and the hopes that you have for our city?
Kind of what we touched on earlier. My vision is to see access for all, to education, to housing, to employment, but also to see fair and impartial policing in all of the 52 neighborhoods of our city. And that police are here and we do no harm.
Yeah.
We reduce crime, but we do no harm. Mm. And I think that is, harm being done in the profession is a legacy that we have to overcome. Mm. So that's kind of my desire, is to be here and be intimately involved in our neighborhoods, but do no harm.
Yeah, that's a compelling vision. Mm. That's a compelling vision, and I know it's one that you have already made strides on and will continue to. One last question, and that is, there's a lot to love about our city. And you probably, more than other people, know all the nooks and crannies and the ins and outs of Cincinnati. So tell me three things you just love about Cincinnati. It could be a place, it could be a whatever it is. What do you love about Cincinnati?
Oh, wow. I love the skyline of our city. Mm-hmm. You know, to be a city on the river and to know the history of our city. Our city has, there's a myriad of history here. Mm-hmm. You know, that this was really the gateway west for so long. Mm-hmm. And why our city was the Queen City. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful city, a great place to live. It's a world-class city that I don't think people realize. Mm-hmm. We have an exceptional zoo. Yeah. The art here is just unbelievable. The talent that comes out of our city, mm-hmm. I think, is just far too often unrecognized. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we're a very unique city, I think. I think we're too far north to be south and too far south to be north.
Yes, we're somewhere in between,
right? We're kind of that city in the middle that that is unique. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think, you know, that is why there's so much potential here that just really, it just needs to flourish. It's a diverse city that just needs to, at times, get out of its own way to really be as great as it can be.
Yeah. Well, we're really thankful to have you be part of that in your leadership. So thank you so much for the
time. All right, my pleasure.
I really
my
appreciate
pleasure.
It.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. And a special thank you to all of the police officers and first responders who protect and serve. We are very thankful for you. I Love Cincinnati is a production of Crossroads Church in Cincinnati, Ohio. If you want to hear more from us, drop us a line on Instagram or Facebook at I Love Cincy Show. That's I Love Cincy, C-I-N-C-Y, Show. Thanks for listening. See you in the next episode.